This podcast is sponsored by Athletic Greens. Now, you've probably heard of Athletic Greens from 1,000 different podcasts, and the reason why I believe is because it works. This is something I've been using every single day, and the biggest things that I've realized for myself is that I have more energy, I rarely if ever get sick, my poops are better, okay? There's multiple benefits here, and if you are interested in trying it, I have a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 plus K2 and 5 AG1 travel packs by using the link drinkag1.com/Farzad. And my gut tells me, no pun intended, that you're going to love this product. Now onto the podcast.
So apparently there is some very interesting developments in our understanding of the accounting for megapacks. And those developments have very significant implications for the development of the energy business for Tesla as a whole, profits, margin profiles, and then just the long-term earnings potential of the energy business for Tesla. And so, yeah, we just wanted to let Matt get in here and share with us some of what he has been diving into after a conversation yesterday with Larry, who kind of opened his eyes on some things. And so, yeah, Matt, go for it. Share with us what you've learned.
Yeah, and so all credit to Larry for his work here, and I'll try to kind of set it up at a high level first, and then we can maybe dive into it. But serious shout out to Larry Goldberg. If you guys aren't following him, you're definitely missing out. So essentially, the main point here, which was eye opening to me, was the fact that Tesla has some unearned revenue. Now, we've known that Tesla's got this deferred revenue. I should say to speak more accurately. We've known, for example, that when Tesla delivers a megapack, they don't recognize all that revenue up front because there are different milestones. So like delivery is one milestone, you know, energization is one milestone. There's a milestone of when they actually meet the performance obligations, and then there's like a milestone with commercial operation state. So like that whole process can take 18 months, and it's pretty well known, and it's not really that big of a deal. The idea is, okay, you recognize the revenue at each of those milestones, but then there are, you know, the costs that you incur to manufacture the megapack also kind of get recognized pro rata with a revenue recognition. So it's not like you've got an increase in margin, at least for that portion of the revenue that's being recognized. So that was, you know, kind of my baseline understanding, is that like because of this thing in GAAP called the matching principle, you're matching the costs that it took to build something in the same period that you're recognizing those revenues. Well, apparently there was a change to the matching principles and to some of these rules. I think it's like ASC 306 or something like that. I know enough accounting to be dangerous, but I'm not an accountant that's like following the latest developments on revenue recognition thing. So I'm sure I'll get some of the details wrong, but I think at a high level, this is essentially what happened. So what used to be what I thought was kind of like this rock solid matching principle where you're like any costs incurred to develop some revenue, I have to be recognized in the same period that the revenue is recognized. So I think what's happened is, and what Larry pointed out, is there are some pieces of the deferred revenue balance that are kind of disjointed from the manufacturing cost that would go with them. And so let's take a pause there and think about what are the actual components of deferred revenue, just like operationally, and just so people can kind of understand what we're talking about in a little bit more layman's terms. Then we'll dive back into the accounting. So there are warranties that Tesla has, and there is maintenance agreements that Tesla has. So there's an actual contract agreement, usually for 10 years, that Tesla will service the Megapack, and you know there's like exact like milestones of what they're going to do by what time, you know, replace the inverters in year 7 or whatever the specifics of the maintenance that the megapacks need. Tesla's obligated under their contract to do that. So that, essentially is deferred revenue. But when it's recognized, when the maintenance is actually performed, there's going to be costs that Tesla incurs at that same time. So I've always viewed this as not particularly exciting. It's like, yeah, they're going to have some maintenance and it'll cost Tesla something and the margins will be what they are. And it's not all that interesting. But the last piece, which I think is potentially a lot more interesting, is they have these performance guarantees. So if Tesla delivers a mega pack, it has all these specifications. So it's, you know, 3.9 megawatt hours. They're going to give some guarantee on the duration, you know, it's 2 or 4 hour duration, you know, the actual capacity. So I forget what is it, 1.8, 1.9 megawatt capacity, something like that. So like all the actual physical capabilities of the equipment are guaranteed by Tesla. Now, they're not able to actually recognize all of the revenue until the tests are actually performed on the equipment in the field that says, okay, yeah, this actually is a 3.9 megawatt hour, you know, mega pack, and all the, you know, guarantees that you contractually said you would deliver, those have been met. Once that happens, Tesla's able to recognize the revenue. The point Larry was making, and all of the balance might not be this, but I think this is probably the largest chunk of it. There's no additional cost to Tesla of delivering, you know, those guarantees, because I already made the equipment. Under the new accounting rules, they've actually delivered the equipment. And so once the equipment gets delivered, all of the inventory costs, all the manufacturing costs get expensed. So this means that like the margin that we've been seeing historically from Tesla, assuming there's still this, I think it's like $2.7 billion of this unsatisfied performance obligations outstanding right now. A good chunk of that is probably this revenue that maybe doesn't have costs associated with it because it's just these performance guarantees. So in other words, all the costs of manufacturing the mega packs that have been deployed to date have already run through the income statement, but not all the revenue has. And that's like that's a very big deal, because if that's the case, then as you know, more and more mega packs are getting deployed and Tesla's able to achieve, you know, 25% ish gross margins with what they've been deploying to date under this accounting scheme. If they're able to recognize an incremental, you know, $3.9 billion in growing of this deferred revenue as they kind of meet these performance obligations, but there's no additional cost associated with them, then the implication is that your margins are actually going to be growing from the 25% going forward. So that's the really kind of staggering assumption around where margins could be going. And then when you couple that with the fact that we were like so blown away, surprised on the upside of the actual deployments last quarter. And so though, like Lathrop appears to actually be ramping at or near its stated capacity. And then you've got Shanghai Megapack factory coming online next year. Like all of a sudden you could be talking about, you know, the steady state where we were, which was like, I don't know, 4 gigawatt hours ish per quarter, to when both of those factories are up and running, it's going to be more like 20 gigawatt hours per quarter. And then if you start doing the math on what that implies around like revenue and then at a 35% gross margin, you go from like energy being, you know, like kind of nice, but not that exciting, to potentially like dollars of earnings per share in very quick order. Now, I think I might still disagree with Larry on some of this, but like just to frame it, Larry's point on when we were discussing this on Herbert's show yesterday was according to his math, he's seeing that the gross margin from energy by the end of 2025 is actually going to be higher than the gross margin on the auto side of the business, at least like excluding robotaxis or, you know, any uptick in FSD, anything like that. I can't quite get there with the numbers, even if I'm, you know, giving a little bit of credit for
gross margin dollars, right? Gross margin dollars.
Gross margin dollars. Like, you know, we all know that the gross margin percentage is already higher and like that's super exciting and nice, but like pretty much nobody's expecting gross margin dollars to be higher or even like in the same ballpark. So when I was doing the math yesterday, I was coming up with something like $7 billion of energy gross margin next year. And this is very napkin math, so take it with a grain of salt. But like that's, if you tax effect that a little bit, you're talking roughly like $2 per share, a little bit under that in earnings. And so if you weren't baking that into your model and, you know, you like had kind of more reasonable assumptions around energy, I think most of us and frankly, the market was kind of expecting, all right, Tesla's going to do, I don't know, $2.50, $2.60, something like that in earnings per share this year. Next year, maybe they'll do $2.70, something like that. So like the kind of growth story is dead and earnings are down and volumes are down year over year. That's been, I think, the dominant narrative, at least before this week, for the last, I don't know, year, when Tesla's had this slide. And so this one point could like single-handedly take the stock from like, you know, or the earnings profile of Tesla from, you know, 250-ish in earnings per share and like no growth to like $4. And all of a sudden you've got like very drastically growing earnings per share. And that can help kind of like bridge the gap to a return to growth on the auto business and autonomy and all the things that we're excited about. So it is a very big deal. and I think there's more to unpack here, but that's the overview of what it is and why it matters.
Okay, so let me try to summarize this for my stupid brain and then tell me if this is way too simplistic. Nothing? Come on, I just gave you like a layup and you're not, wow. That's okay. I'm impressed.
Last chance. I'll wait until you say the stupid thing and then I'll
run. Okay. How about that? Fair enough. All right, let's do it. Okay. So is it fair to describe this thing that's happening with energy? It's very similar to the FSD, deferred revenue on the auto side, where you have revenue that Tesla has been holding back based on the completion of some features. To the point where they can start recognizing the revenue, and that revenue would have no cost associated to it because it's just software. Is that a fair way of thinking about this sort of thing that's happening on the energy side?
Yeah, I think that actually is a fair way of thinking about it. It's, you know, in effect, it'll be very similar, but like the actual accounting of it is I think quite well. Maybe it's actually not quite that different, but. Yeah, that is a reasonable way to kind of view it. I mean, there's in the one case you're delivering like actual FSD capability that you've promised, and in the other case, you have to actually prove that your equipment works the way that you say it will. And there's actually contractual obligations, like if the Megapack, let's say, is only putting out 3.5 megawatt hours rather than 3.9, then Tesla's actually on the hook to pay the customer like a set dollar amount, which is predefined, and so that's where like this revenue could potentially not get recognized to the extent they actually have to, you know, make these liquidated damages payments. But in that case, like from an income statement perspective, if this accounting is correct, then like there's no revenue recognized, but it's not like there's an offset expense or anything like that because you've already accounted for this in your reserve on your liabilities.
Got it. And so what percentage of the revenue is deferred? So you threw out a number of 25% to 35% potentially. So is there something in the contract that says, you know, you're paying 50% upfront and you pay the remainder of the 50% once we can prove to you that we're doing what we said we're going to do? What's that actual number? Or is it contract by contract?
So it's going to be contract by contract, and we don't have perfect visibility into this. And even if we had perfect visibility into the contract terms, because there's so many different projects out there, we wouldn't really be able to kind of map it one for one and kind of make a great estimate of how much is going to be recognized. But yeah, there are these milestones, and it's probably important to note that like there's the payment milestone. So when does the customer actually pay Tesla the cash? But from a financial reporting perspective, what really matters and what's reported in the quarterly results that we're going to see is when is Tesla allowed to recognize the revenue? And so the, you know, a big piece of it is not going to be recognized until, you know, like until the project is energized. And because these are, it's not like delivering a car, like you have to actually physically deliver the thing to the site. Then you've got to get it like all hooked up and connected. Then you've got to like energize it. And you can't do that until like you've got all your like, electrical, you know, equipment all hooked up. And then generally speaking, you can't do final commercial operations until the grid interconnect agreement is in place, which is where like the Megapack can actually be interacting with the grid as opposed to like maybe just doing some testing in an isolated fashion. So like there's that whole time frame can be maybe 18 months. So you're like recognizing kind of chunks along the way. But to get you an idea of like how much, like what this process looks like. All right, so we're in the latest 10Q. This is for Q1, the period ending in March. We have a note here that says, as of March 31st, 2024, the total transaction price allocated to performance obligations that were unsatisfied or partially unsatisfied for contracts with an original expected length of more than 1 year was $3.86 billion. And of this amount, $1 billion is going to be recognized over the next 12 months. So this is kind of like the magnitude of the opportunity that we're talking about. So $3.86 billion is the amount that's deferred. And just for context, the total energy revenue in Q1 was about $1.6 billion. So this is like multiple quarters of deferred energy and of deferred energy revenues. And if it truly is significantly related to these performance milestones, these unsatisfied performance obligations, then it could be a very high margin piece of revenue.
And so what percentage of that $3.86 billion is the piece you were talking about that is related to that 100% margin where you don't have to assign any costs to that?
So we can't know that definitively, but you know, you can kind of make some reasonable estimates. So like the biggest piece to kind of think about that would be very long term in nature is going to be the maintenance contracts. So you've got like 10-year contracts. I've done some rough math on this, and this is going to be like very rough because it's based off my memory. But I think the total amount of the maintenance contracts, if you like aggregate it over the lifetime of a megapack, it's something like 14% of the purchase price. And it's going to be recognized over 10 years. So like that is going to be pretty small. And so if you think of, okay, cumulatively over all the megapacks that they've sold. So I've got total energy revenue of about $12 billion going back to Q1 of 2022. A bit of that solar. So let's say, I don't know, just $10 billion is energy storage. So if you've got $10 billion and 14% of that is related to kind of like future maintenance obligations, you're talking like maybe $1.4 billion-ish of stuff that's maintenance related. So then the other, what was the total number? 2.8.
Two thirds of it is 100% margin potentially.
Yeah. So like 3.8 of the minus the 1.4 is like two thirds, like you said, is going to be the super high margin stuff. If this kind of thesis is correct, and we should steelman that in a little bit, but that's kind of the high level way I'm thinking about it.
And so that 3.86, again, if I look at that 10Q, if I pull this up real quick, then it's under the energy generation and storage sales. So the 3.86 billion is a subset of the total deferred revenue. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yep. So they started breaking this out separately recently, but they've got a very similar paragraph on the auto side of the business. But yeah, this 3.86 is specifically on energy.
I guess, yeah, one of the questions that I was trying to understand, maybe this is where we're going, is whether of that 3.86 billion, how much of that is recognizable over that 18-month period, and then how much of it might be like those 10-year maintenance contracts. I think that's, I guess if we just watch the financials or maybe even look at old financials and kind of move forward, we may be able to kind of back into that number.
So, I mean, if we go with the numbers that we just kind of worked through, then you've got, so the 3.8, it like if we take the 1.4 that we just estimated, then you're left with 2.4 of stuff that's maybe this performance obligations. They say they're going to recognize, you know, $1 billion of that over the next 12 months. And so that to me gives a pretty good indication, and a very small portion of that's going to be maintenance, but some of that will be maintenance. So maybe like of the $1 billion that they expect to be recognized, a good chunk of that, probably most of that's going to be these performance obligations. And so then that would imply that you've got another like $1.4 billion-ish that's going to be for recognizing, you know, 25 and beyond in like stuff like megapacks that they've maybe sold now, but aren't even close to getting to the point where they're testing the equipment.
And that 2.4 billion would be on sales of roughly, so yeah, that 2.4 billion that was deferred, that we think is tied to the very high margin piece of the revenue was done on sales from the last 18 months or so, which would total no more than $9 billion, right? So you're essentially adding $2.4 billion of profit to a $9 billion of revenue where you've already recognized the COGS for. Is that a good way of thinking about it?
Yeah, that's right.
So you're essentially, so you are adding 25%, or what was the math? Roughly call it 20%. So you're literally adding 20% more, actually a little bit more, closer to 30%. 30% more sales at 100% margin, we think.
That's about right. And it actually kind of solves a problem that's been annoying me about my model. Because Tesla, like
you're for welcome. The
last couple, I don't even know what you just said.
You're welcome, I said.
Well, I will direct that to Larry, not to you. but one of the things I've tried to do when I'm estimating the energy revenue is to say, okay, you know, they've deployed 3.9 gigawatt hours or 3.7 gigawatt hours, whatever the number is in their quarterly reports. And if you look at the, if you kind of make an estimate of the solar revenue and you back that out, you're left with an estimate of the storage revenue. And if you divide the storage revenue by the storage deployed, you get numbers that don't really make sense. So like in Q1 of last year, I was calculating $333 per kilowatt hour. In Q2, I was calculating $343. In Q3, I was calculating $350. And these are pieces of these megapacks that during those periods was priced a lot closer to like $450, $470 per kilowatt hour. So they're like roughly $100 per kilowatt hour missing, which to your point, Farzad, is like a third of the total like contract price. So this really kind of clicks for me that, okay, that's where that missing kind of ASP might be. It could just be all kind of ending up in this unsatisfied performance obligations.
And so how do we confirm that the accounting of that 2.4 billion that we think is deferred that has essentially no COGS attached to it, which would make it 100% margin, it just drops to the bottom line. How do we confirm that that's totally the case? Is it literally in the contract verbiage and in the 10Q?
Well, the 10Q verbiage is pretty vague. So this is something, you know, that I've noticed. It's not like I've never read this stuff before. I've gone through this and there's nothing in there that like screams, hey, by the way, like this is 100% pure margin deferred revenue. Like it's more detailed than they used to give us, but it's still like, you know, it doesn't distinguish, for example, between the maintenance, which very clearly has a cost of goods sold, and this, you know, like actual equipment performance kind of milestones, which are reserved, that it is a very different cost profile based on the new accounting. So, you know, Larry has said that he spoke with three different accountants to kind of go over this, his understanding of it. And they kind of agree that while the verbiage is like a little bit gray, when you actually stop and think about the journal entries that would be required, and this is what convinced me, like there's no other way to do it, like to make these numbers make sense. It's pretty clear to me that the accounting is right, but I think we're going to need to wait to see in the quarterly reports if the margins are going to go up, because the only way we're really going to see it is if like the margins start going up like from 25% to 29 to like the 30% mid 30% range and even higher, which is what Larry's estimates were. You know, I kind of stopped paying too close attention to this point in particular when Zach Kirkhorn gave that guidance a while ago, basically saying he was targeting like 25% gross margins on the energy side of the business. It's like, okay, great. They made it there. Like, that's exactly where we are today. And so I was like, all right, well, let's just assume that and kind of go forward. But the more I look at Larry's point, I'm like, I actually struggle to see how it would be wrong.
So you think so that there might be a potential sandbag from Zach before he departed on the energy side of the business, which would be definitely a surprise. But here's the thing with energy, right? So if you recall a year and a half ago, we were talking about this sort of potential explosion in the energy side of the business that hasn't come to fruition until potentially now. And a lot of that, so a lot of that was around the whole concept of the credits that Tesla would receive from the IRA, right? That was like one of the things we were talking about. It's like, hey, there's a bunch of credits out there. The IRA, Tesla's going to be able to capitalize on by manufacturing cells in-house, and they're going to be, you know, they're going to take a bunch of costs. They're going to be able to lower the cost so much through that credit that's going to allow them to essentially boost their margins tremendously. Now, that's assuming that they're not going to lower the pricing to match that credit amount. So instead of passing it on to the customer, they would just keep it, right? So that's one thing to think through. But now, like, we're at the point, it seems, that like this number that Tesla just shared on the Q2 delivery and production report of essentially almost tripling, more than doubling their previous quarter's deployment of energy, which aligns very closely to Lathrop's stated capacity of about 40 gigawatts per year, right?
Yeah.
So one would assume that if this were to hold, that Tesla's new revenue levels are going to be mirroring Q2 versus Q1. Which, in a loose way, would say that revenues will go up by about 2.5 times, let's say, quarter over quarter, Q2 versus Q1, and then they will hold around that level, which then says, so what was the revenue for the quarter? $1.6 billion in Q1, something like that?
For energy, yeah, $1.6 billion.
For energy? Yeah. Got it. So then it would go up to, say, $4 billion per quarter of revenue if there was a one-to-one correlation. Okay, so let me ask you this question. Is there a one-to-one correlation in revenue versus gigawatt hours deployed, even if we assume all the different deferments and everything? Like, is that a good way of thinking about the energy piece?
It's a good rule of thumb. And in the long term, yes. I take that back. In the long term, yes-ish. But a couple things. First, because of call it 18-month revenue recognition life cycle, like the deployments is just one chunk of the revenue that's going to be recognized. So, you know, it could be the case that they count as deployed because the customer, you know, essentially takes delivery and it goes off Tesla's books as inventory. And so like that's a very big milestone, but they won't be recognizing like the full amount of the revenue from all of the 9.4 gigawatt hours that they deployed in Q2. They're not going to like see full recognition of that in Q2. So that's one point, is that it's probably going to be like you'll get that benefit certainly over the next 18 months, and you definitely will see a spike. Like there's no way there's not going to be a spike in revenue this month, but it might be slightly lower than what you were saying.
I guess the point I'm trying to make though is that thank you for that, but I guess where I'm trying to get to is it's a 2.5 times-ish, let's say, increase. So in Q2, we should expect revenues to be much closer to 3.5 to 4 billion or 3.5 billion versus 1.6. But then that new base over time could potentially have an additional 30% of revenue at 100% margin on that new higher base that will flow to the bottom line as that deferred revenue gets recognized, right? So instead of talking about $2.4 billion of deferred revenue for the last 18 months, 18 months from now, it's going to be 2.5 times that, right? It's going to be whatever that is, $6, $7 billion of deferred revenue. And I think that's going to be interesting to track, right? So if the deferred revenue goes up by that much, right, and then we start seeing the flow through from the last 18 months reflected in margin, then we've confirmed that what Larry's been saying is correct.
What about the impact of the price reductions on Megapack over the last, you know, call it 18 months? Because the prices have come down quite a bit, and I, you know, potentially could continue to go down.
That was actually what I was going to bring up next, Han. So the great transition. So that is a very significant change, which I think I also didn't realize until yesterday. Tesla had the Megapack page from their website down for many months, but I just went there yesterday and saw that it was actually back up. So you can actually look at the pricing, and where the pricing a year ago was in the roughly $450 per kilowatt hour range that I was talking about before. Now it's, what is it? I think it's like $280 or something like that. So Is that the Powerwall, Farzad? That's not a mega pack.
Oh, I'm fucking dumb.
No arguments from Matt.
Napoleon that said, when your enemy is making a mistake, don't interrupt them.
Thanks, asshole. All right, here we go. You want to read your shitty post?
Yeah,
go for it.
Sure. So on Hans's point around pricing, this is something that I was not aware of until yesterday. The pricing last April, so April of 2023, was at around $482 per kilowatt hour. This is just based on a screenshot Sawyer shared from that time. I went to Tesla's Megapack website yesterday and just like for this exact same project, so it's apples to apples, what was the pricing? And if you look at that, it's a $266 per kilowatt hour new price. So over a 40% reduction in a little over a year in the pricing. So like while deployments are, let's say, doubling or like more than that, if pricing is coming down significantly, that's certainly going to limit the upside potential in terms of revenue. And it might also present a fair amount of margin pressure too, which it's certainly remains to be seen how much, unsatisfied performance obligation, like that pure margin kind of tailwind that we talked about, is probably going to be offset pretty significantly by this, headwind of lower prices. But a couple important points here, and then I'll turn it back over. But one is that like the pricing from previous projects is still going to be honored. So a lot of the revenue that they're recognizing in Q2 is going to be for hitting the milestones of a project that they initially signed up, a year ago or 18 months ago, just as it's hitting those milestones. So that will be at the higher pricing, but those contracts also have a pass-through in lithium carbonate price, which is one of the most significant drivers of price. So the Tesla's revenue, like the dollars per kilowatt hour that they're seeing, is probably going to decrease, but that's also very much offset by the lower lithium prices. And like Elon has talked about, the being flooded with cheap cells that's going on right now. So that both of those things are going to limit a little bit the revenue growth potential that you might calculate if you just did like a pure one-for-one extrapolation of the deployments.
But the gross margins and the proportion of the deferred revenue to the total revenue would still be the same-ish, right?
It might because, even increase as might I'm thinking increase? About it. Because like if you, so I actually was developing a power plant project a number of years ago, and one of my jobs was actually to calculate the liquidated damages. So we were buying equipment from GE, and it said like a guaranteed output rate and all these other like a heat rate, all these different components, and you can do the math of like what does it actually cost you, the project owner, if the equipment doesn't perform as you were expecting. And so like there's very easy, or not easy, but there's very like clear ways you can run those calculations, do a present value on it and say, okay, like if you, are short 1 megawatt on me, here's how much it costs me. And so then you like stick that in the contract, parties agree to it. You say like, yeah, just based on market prices, that would be your harm if my equipment didn't perform to the level that I guaranteed. And that's like that level of harm is not going to change because the overall contract price decreased, because it's more about the forward like revenue and margin opportunity of the project. It's not about the cost. So as I'm thinking about it, actually, probably that piece of the equation is going to increase.
Got it. Okay. Hans, I was going to say something, but then I fucking blanked.
I've been trying to think about the way that, all this revenue recognition is spread out. And what I'm wondering is if there is essentially a way to do an 18-month trailing deployments average and associate that with current revenue recognition and then use that to project forward based on monthly deployments at this point in time.
I actually did that about 18 months ago. And kind of what I found is that it wasn't giving me any more accuracy than a more simple model where you're basically just making an estimate of the deployments and the estimated dollar per kilowatt hour. Given the huge spike that we have right now in deployments, that might be more beneficial today than it had been in the past. Because like this is actually one of my key questions. Like as I'm looking at my model right now, Q1, my estimate was an average storage price of $366 per kilowatt hour, and you had 4 gigawatt hours. So now I've got 9.4 gigawatt hours being deployed, more than double. What's a reasonable way to estimate the amount that's going to be recognized? Like, do you take that 366 number and like cut it in half because so much of the deployed is going to be recognized later? It's probably not that extreme, but like I could make an argument for it to be like 350, and I could also make an argument for it to be like 250. So it's going to be very hard to tell. And so if we have revenue this quarter that's like $3 billion on the energy side instead of four, then I think that will warrant modeling it in the way that you suggested, Hans. And that's probably what I'll end up doing because it is. But even then, like there's like this huge spike that we are seeing recognized. Like you have no visibility into when those milestones are going to be met. You can make an estimate, just kind of assume it's smooth-ish, but like you could just randomly have a bunch of the projects get to commercial operations in, I don't know, Q2 of 2025, and not very many in Q3, and you'll just have like a massive bump, even if deployments don't necessarily spike in that quarter. So it's going to be a little lumpy, and there's really because we've got such imperfect information, it's going to just be an estimate no matter how you do it.
I think what's super interesting about this whole thing, and this is kind of like trying to tie it to the entire company that is Tesla, right? Because this energy thing has been a dormant thing that we've tried our best to understand how it's going to play out in the future. And it's every time it's been disappointing, right? It's like, oh, here it comes. Nope. Oh, here it comes. Nope. Oh, here it comes. Nope. But now that it seems like we have the first signal that says, oh, it's here now in some way, right? We're all like, I don't know how to do it. I don't know how to do it. Like, it's so confusing. But it's interesting because if let's say the growth in gigawatt hours in Q2 versus Q1 correlates closely to the revenue growth we're going to see. So we'll go and say the margins stay relatively the same around that 20-25%. Margin, you all of a sudden you're adding close to $1 billion of profit to the bottom line. Like it goes from a $400 million a quarter profit, gross profit business to about $1 billion, right? And then if you put this within the context, so the math I'm doing there is if I look at Q1, energy generation and storage, $1.6 billion for revenue, and then COGS is 1.2, so that's $400 million profit, right? And then you times that by 2.5-ish, you'll get to about $1 billion, assuming that margin's the same, right? And then we're not talking about deferred revenue or anything like that, which we think will come later. But even just there, so all of a sudden, Tesla is able to unlock a total of about $4 billion a year of gross profit that will flow to the bottom line in some way to help them fund their AI stuff, right? And this thing could potentially set to grow once Shanghai's live in 2025, late 2025, whenever that's fully ramped. To your point, that could add yet another 40 gigawatt hours of volume, which will increase revenues by another 2x or 1.8x or whatever that math is, right? So which will, if margin stays the same, then all of a sudden, to your point, you go to $2 billion a quarter of gross profit, $8 billion a year that Tesla can again use to fund their current operations on top of the profit they're getting from their vehicle side, which I also want to talk about if you have time, because now we might have this dynamic starting Q2 where you're going to have return of gross margins potentially above 20% for the auto business, especially as Cybertruck is ramping up and Tesla pulls the lever on interest and low interest rate financing, so on and so forth, right? So it's like, it's just fascinating to see, like all of a sudden we're talking about another $1 billion of profit per quarter that could come very shortly.
It's really nice. And that $1 billion, like you said, I mean, if you kind of tax effect it and you get to, let's call it $3 billion just to be a little bit on the conservative side, assume some operating expenses that like, or I lost my mental math capacities, just completely exploded live there. Annualized would be like $3 billion, which is like a dollar per share. So, and like when I was doing the math this quarter, I was like, holy crap, I can't believe how much earnings growth sequentially just came out of the energy side of the business. Because it was like 15 cents per share when I was assuming something like 40 cents per share all in. And so between like the energy or the energy sales beat and the auto like beat, it's like, okay, my expectation was like mid 40s, and now I'm calculating like low 60s. So it's an immediate benefit. But then I think the more important thing for investors is to say, okay, like regardless of like the revenue recognition and like all this like accounting nonsense that like matters, but it also doesn't really matter. Like just think about the long-term picture. And so like, I don't know exactly when projects are going to recognize revenue or what the ultimate pricing is going to be, but we know that Lathrop and Shanghai are both going to be doing 40 gigawatt hours at some point in the future. They're going to grow like after that too. But like, just do some simple math where you say, all right, you know, $40 or 40 gigawatt hours annually. And let's assume pricing is low, like we're assuming here, or like their newest pricing is. So let's just say it's, you know, $250 per kilowatt hour. Well, then you're doing $10 billion in revenue. And it, like, if you want to, you can just make whatever margin assumption you want. If you want Larry's assumption that it's, you know, like 35%, if you want to keep it just conservative, let's just say it's, 25%, then you're talking $2.5 billion in margin, like very soon. And like, that's just like very meaningful, like end of next year kind of time frame.
And this is a growing business too, right? So this isn't like a between Lathrop and Shanghai, you have 80 gigawatt hours, right? This is like this is where we're starting from, and then it's going to continue growing as more and more markets adopt this technology, right? So like what I'm thinking through right now is, if we think about what happened to the stock price in the last week or so, is this the market recognizing this, or is that something else, right? Because if, when I think of this business, like the whole thing I'm trying to figure out here is like, is this finally the lever that gives somebody like a Warren Buffett the thing that says, ooh, easy business to understand, incredibly high demand, make batteries, slap them into the place, walk away. Is that finally the thing that gets those big money guys to jump in and say, okay, now this is simpler. It's not based on the super long-term potential. I know the answer is no, right? But it's like, I wonder if there's a little bit in there that's like, okay, it can't get any simpler than this. You're buying batteries, or you're making batteries, you're putting them in a box and you're slapping it into a thing. Like you get a cabinet, you put batteries in there and you put the cabinet in a place. How fucking hard can that be? You know, it's hard, but I'm saying like, that doesn't seem like a hard concept to understand from an investment thesis perspective, right? I don't know.
That's not the hard part. The hard part is who the customer. And I'll let Matt talk about that.
Okay, while he explains that, I'm going to leave my headphones on. I'm going to go pee and then go ahead and explain that.
Thanks for all that detail. I do think Farzad, it's actually a good point. Like, I'll kind of take issue with the fact that the business is super easy. But I do think, you know, if you're just some institutional manager of funds and, you know, you're like, do I invest in Tesla? And the story 6 months ago was, well, auto sales really suck, but hey, FSD looks promising and like robotaxis could be big. Like that's you know, you're kind of betting on the come there to like Elon solves it and it'll be great. This, it's so much easier to wrap your head around. Like you were saying, you can do the simple math of like, okay, how much does the business grow? What are the margins? And like the thing that I think is just so compelling is this is a business that's got, you know, 25% gross margins right now. Let's just assume that we're going to be reasonable and assume they stay there. And it's growing at triple digits. If we're talking about potentially, billions of dollars of margin next year, what kind of PE multiple should you apply to that? If your top line is growing at 100% and you like you have a goal of going from, let's say a run rate last year of like 12 to 15 gigawatt hours, you're going from that to a long term. target of like 1,000 gigawatt hours, which is a terawatt hour. like the runway here for very high growth at very good margins is extremely long. So I do think that like this is easier for some institutional investors to kind of wrap their head around and say, oh, I was ignoring energy because it has sucked forever, but now it's becoming real. And there's like easier for me to put this in my Excel model and say, oh, like, actually, I've done the math and I think it's worth $200 billion, whatever, you know, your math gets you to, you know, that's very easy to kind of then add that to your model and say, okay, well, I thought it was worth 170 a share, but now that I'm, you know, doing the math, I can pump it up to, you know, whatever, 250 or something like that. I do think that's a real kind of catalyst here, that it's just forcing everyone to put this in their models.
And then how much of the glut in batteries that Elon's been talking about, which we've seen, so like all the auto manufacturers like GM and Ford and everybody else that has been delaying plans, canceling plans, which is putting suppliers in limbo with potential manufacturing capacity that they've built out. And then these guys have decided to pull back because they can't make an EV at a profit, right? And so in the current glut of batteries and the plummeting lithium prices, which in theory is going to give Tesla the ability to bring in much cheaper cells in the next 12 to 18 months, how much of those batteries are interchangeable between auto and energy? I'm assuming every single one of them, right? It's not like you need a specific type of, I'll let the expert answer that question.
I mean, Tesla's strategy, I think, on both the auto and the stationary storage side has been to be very flexible with their cells. And that has been a tremendous benefit to them. So like, Hans, you mentioned this earlier, and I wanted to circle back to it. A lot of people were getting kind of bulled up on energy because of the IRA credits. You get a $24 per kilowatt hour benefit, a direct payment essentially for making cells in the United States. So if Tesla was making, you know, their 4680s and putting them into the packs, they'd get this $24 per kilowatt hour, which if you do the math, like on the, I think they had a 100 gigawatt hour expansion of Giga Nevada planned, which was going to be using 4680s. It ends up being like, I think it was like $4.9 billion a year of margin potential just on the credit. It's like very significant. But if you look at what's happened in cells, I mean, we don't know exactly Tesla's pricing, but a couple of years ago, we know they were in the like $100 per kilowatt hour range just at the cell level. Some reports I'm seeing now from people who are in the space is that like with the dumping of cells going on right now, it's like some of them are going for like $50 per kilowatt hour, which is kind of wild. So you've got like a $50 reduction when we were getting all excited about a $24 credit. And so if your input cost, your primary input cost, let's say is this, you know, $50, maybe we'll be more conservative and say it's $75 per kilowatt hour cell. And you were selling it at $480 and now you're selling it at, what is it, 280, something like that, or 272, I think it was. Okay, your price has come down, but like your input cost has also come down pretty drastically. So I do think that that the lower price that we're seeing is going to be maybe not as significant of a compressing function on margins as maybe we might have initially thought.
But if it's just as simple as like slapping batteries in and, you know, putting it in a cabinet, installing it somewhere, why has this taken so long for this business to start taking off and this revenue to be recognized? I mean, you know, they've been deploying lots and lots of gigawatt hours. So like, why, what are the things that slows this whole process down? And then I'll have a follow-up question.
There are many answers to that, but I'll kind of give a couple different flavors to it. You know, one is like ramping, you know, Lathrop has not ramped as quickly as we thought. We don't know all the reasons why that's the case. But I think it's really important to remember like the purchasing cycle of these customers. I mean, most of these are going to large utility customers that are planning on a project and trying to, you know, get it deployed. And or in some cases, it might be like a solar plus storage plant. I follow a lot of these companies and kind of across the board, the commentary that I've heard on their earnings calls is a lot of our projects have slipped because the interconnect delays are taking longer or just the general project development timeline, like the IRS regulations or guidelines for the domestic content that's going to be allowed to be recognized took like two and a half years or something like that to actually get rolled out. And even now there's some uncertainty around like what companies can claim as actual domestic content in order to get the 10% bonus on their ITC, on their investment tax credit. And so a lot of this kind of uncertainty, these regulatory uncertainty and the interconnect issues has caused some problems, some projects just to their development timeline has stretched out. So if you contacted Tesla in say 2022 and you've got this project that you're developing and you think it's going to come online in, you know, Q4 2023, here we are in Q3 2024, and you know, maybe now you're just starting to get ready to take delivery now because you had all these unforeseen delays. So I think the fact that Tesla is actually delivering these to specific projects and are working with the actual project development timelines. This could be the case, but I don't think there's many companies that are actually just buying these mega packs and kind of stockpiling them to resell to other customers down the road. So the actual delays in the actual projects themselves, which are definitely very real, could explain a chunk of the reason that we have seen this delay in Megapack ramping.
And so is that a reason for someone who's investing in Tesla around the Tesla Energy business thesis to be like, hey, maybe this thing isn't just going to grow super fast and in this unrestrained way if the customers are slow quasi-government agencies that are not only subject to, a lot of bureaucracy to begin with, but something that's already going to take a long time is not only going to take a long time, but then it's going to get slower over time instead of faster over time.
I think you're right that the slow nature of the approval process can be annoying. But as an investor, what's more important, that you've got a crappy sales cycle and regulatory red tape, or this long-term secular trend of massive amounts of new storage getting added to the grid? So this is an aggregation of all of the grid interconnect queues in the United States. And so this blue one is what really matters. So this is all of the storage projects that are in the queue right now trying to get connected to the grid. Now, not all of these projects will be built. But what you can see is in 2023, you had roughly a terawatt of capacity of new batteries that are trying to connect to the grid. This is absolutely massive. And so if you're looking backwards and you look at the really mediocre pedestrian results that Tesla Energy has posted over the last couple of years, saying, I don't know if this business is for me because it just seems like it's slow. Sure, there's lots of promise, but projects get delayed and yada, yada, yada. You're going to be missing this tidal wave that sure is going to be lumpy. There's going to be some projects that could miss. It wouldn't surprise me if we go from 9.2 and gigawatts of deployments this quarter to maybe it's six or seven next quarter, because this is just going to be a little lumpy. But the nature of this trend, this chart here kind of looks like the Tesla stock chart over the last 5 days. It was just an uppercut to the face. So I do think that this is what really matters.
So are these each year, are they cumulative? So if there is a job that's waiting in 2022 and it doesn't get completed in 2022, does it now shift over to 2023?
Yeah, so it's kind of like a snapshot of all the different projects that are in the queue at year end. So one of the, this is a really excellent point, Farzad, because as the interconnect queue length has stretched out from maybe taking, 2 or 3 years a couple of years ago to maybe taking 5 or 6 years now, that has kind of artificially inflated the year or the total here, because it is, it's not a year over year comparison is not particularly helpful when you've got the overall timeline stretching out so drastically right now. So that's certainly true. And a good chunk of these projects are going to drop out. So maybe only 400 end up actually getting deployed. But you still got 400 gigawatts of capacity that needs a buyer, or that needs a supplier, I should say. And there's really no other deployer at scale, at least in the United States right now, that is selling grid storage projects. There's a lot of startups that are trying to make it work. but very few that are operating at, in the gigawatt scale.
And what is the significance of the dark hashed portion on the top of the lines versus just like the solid color?
So that's hybrid. So it's like solar plus storage.
And then what percentage of the terawatt hour that's waiting in storage would be handled by, because it's just the United States, right? So yeah. Of that terawatt hour, how much of that is Tesla?
So it is important to note that this is in gigawatts. So it's not gigawatt hours or terawatts. Well, it's confusing because we normally talk about storage in its capacity terms in gigawatt hours. But for purposes of connecting to the grid, what really matters is, you know, not like your if you think of it as like a pool that has a hose, the size of the pool doesn't matter. The grid wants to know how big is the hose that's like draining the water out of the pool. And so for that reason, capacity is what really matters. So that's just one quick clarification. But of this, like we don't know exactly how much. It doesn't tell you what the storage technology that is that the developer is trying to put in place would be. But I'm guessing a lot of these are going to end up being megapacks because there's just not any other players at scale in the US.
Do we have like a conversion chart that says 1,000 gigawatts correlates to X gigawatt hours?
Yeah. So you can just think of it from the the megapack like design. So one megapack is 3.9 megawatt hours, and it's either 1 megawatt of output if it's a 4 hour, or 1.9 megawatt if it's a 2 hour. So if you want to maybe just take the average, then you could take the output here and multiply it by 3, and that would give you the output in gigawatt hours.
Storage equivalent.
Yeah, so maybe it'd be like 3 terawatt hours of storage that's in here, but probably only 1/3 of it will get built. Maybe it's even less than that.
That's okay. So that's a crazy. So that, thank you for doing that, because now that puts in a scale. Okay. So Lathrop. So tell me this is the right math, because this shit's confusing. So Lathrop is 40 gigawatt hours of capacity per year, and according to this chart, in the United States, let me go back to the thing again. In the United States, there's about one terawatt of capacity in queue, which extrapolates to somewhere around 3 terawatt hours of capacity that's sitting out there waiting to be deployed, right? And Tesla's Lathrop is 40 gigawatt hours, which is 1.3%, like 4%, right? Well, no. Point. No. 40 gigawatts or 40 gigawatt hours is Lathrop?
40 gigawatt hours.
Right. So it'd be like 1.3%, right?
Well, of what? I guess I lost. I thought we were talking about 4% of the 1,000.
Maybe well, no, because it's gigawatt hours. Because Lathrop is gigawatt hours, right? It's 40 gigawatt hours per year. But then we're saying that this chart.
Yeah, it's 1.3%,
right? 1,000 gigawatts of capacity, which that's in queue for 2023, which is equivalent to about 3,000 gigawatt hours of capacity, right? And Lathrop is going to manufacture about 40 gigawatt hours of capacity per year. So on a yearly basis, Lathrop is about 1.3% of at full tilt of the total work that's out there that's waiting to be done.
Yeah, it would take 75 years of production at 40 gigawatt hours every year in order to fulfill that 3 terawatt hour backlog.
What the hell?
That 3 terawatt hour backlog is not all going to be built though. That like the dropout ratio of these projects is extremely high.
What's the ratio?
I was actually trying to run that math today to like have an idea of it. I haven't had a chance to. It's on my to-do list, so I'll probably post about it in the next couple days, because I downloaded like literally all the data of every single project that's in the queue and has been for the last like several years. So you can look at, okay, of all the projects that entered the queue in just let's say 2017, you know, how many of them are actually operational now versus still waiting in the queue versus withdrawn. So I'll do an analysis like that and try to paint the picture, but that's going to be mostly on solar and wind and not so much on storage, because storage wasn't around that much right now. We really don't have a whole lot of years of precedence for how many projects have actually connected to the grid. So I'll try to cut the data a couple different ways and post that later on.
So let me ask the question that I've been building up to, and that is, you know, if you've got these friggin' ridiculous interconnect queues and people are wanting to put in, you know, gigawatt hour worth of compute like today, and they can't for at least 5 years, probably 7, maybe 10, because they just can't get the power from anywhere. How long is it going to be till we start seeing people setting up microgrids that are completely detached from the main grid, where they don't have to go through any sort of regulatory approval process whatsoever, and they can operate on their own timeline? And the only way that you can do that essentially at, you know, a cost-effective way is to go pretty much solar plus megapacks plus, you know, some sort of backup generation technology, whether that's, you know, Bloom Energy fuel cells or diesel generators or whatever. Like, is that something that you expect to start seeing in the next 5 years? And what does that do to the demand for megapacks?
I'd love to say yes, I think that that's going to happen. But I mean, I think that the reality is it's very hard to co-locate like a 500. Well, if you've got a 500 megawatt data center like Tesla's building right now, which is absolutely freaking massive, because the capacity factor on solar is like 25%, that means you'd actually need to build something like 2 gigawatts of solar, probably even more than that, in order to have enough to like meet your ability to run all the time. So that's like an absolutely staggering amount of land that you would need, and plus all the megapacks that you would need in order to kind of balance that. So the idea of data centers building like very massive solar and wind and storage kind of combined facilities behind the meter in order to kind of avoid the interconnect queue, I just don't see that happening as much as I like love the idea, frankly. I did think the Bloom data center like thing made a lot of sense, but I've been surprised that like the data centers don't seem to be going that route. I think they've got such a focus on green generation, like they have to have firm generation, like it has to be 24/7. But they also are saying they want it to be clean. So even though like the Bloom fuel cells are like extremely efficient, they still do emit some CO2. And so I think a lot of these hyperscalers are just saying we can't have any of that. And so if that's the case, like there really isn't a solution that kind of fits what they're looking for. So like the short answer is, I don't know like how to solve this problem. Like I think Elon's prediction from a couple of years ago that there's going to be an electricity shortage, that sounded ridiculous to me at the time. And I do think it's a little hyperbolic. I think what really is going to happen is like there's going to be like a choke point on the approval process of these interconnects. To me, I don't really see a path forward where we're avoiding that. There's some interesting ideas being floated out there. Like there's some pretty impressive breakthroughs on geothermal, which is both clean and firm. But like, again, I don't see a lot of companies trying to co-locate a data center with a geothermal, and that's just a very new kind of nascent technology that it's at least the latest generation of it. It's going to have a hard time scaling up to the level of, you know, multiple gigawatts. So that's a very roundabout way of saying I'm actually skeptical of how big of an opportunity the data center thing in particular is for Megapack. But the kind of constraints that in the increase in demand, and the fact that you've got all this like solar and wind being added, which is intermittent, that's going to create a need for more stability on the grid. And so I think indirectly, that's going to create a lot of demand for grid operators to add more storage to kind of balance this stuff out. So I think that's the way it's going to benefit.
So you don't think the like EV adoption and the AI boom are forcing functions for storage to, you know, grow in unison with that, like along with that, those technologies?
I think they are. The point I'm trying to make is I don't think necessarily like the Microsofts and Metas of the world are going to be like building massive data centers that have like co-located solar and storage at their facilities. I think they're, for the most part, what those companies have been doing is trying to procure PPAs, which like power purchase agreements with the actual owners of the power, and try to like financially kind of match up the clean energy with the amount of consumption that they're making. But I think this absolutely will create more demand for storage. So I don't want to like poo-poo that. But I think ultimately what's going to happen is like developers are going to build like solar and wind, and then grid operators and like to some extent, the developers will add storage to their solar and wind projects too. There'll definitely will be a fair amount of that, but it won't be, I think it'll be like a supply need more so than like a demand pull of saying like the Microsofts of the world saying we want megapacks. All right, so to kind of steel man the reasons why the megapack margin might not be 33%, you know, the first part I would say is that we do have the prices coming down quite a bit, like we were talking about earlier. So you've got prices coming down from, you know, the high or the mid to high $400 per kilowatt hour range to mid to high $200. But that's a very significant decrease. And I think it's reasonable to assume that that's going to outstrip the decrease in cell cost that we were seeing. Because it's over $100 of price decrease and cells, you know, weren't costing more than $100 in total a couple years ago. So that to me is a very good reason why we might see margin compression down to maybe the 25%. I guess it's not compression, it's down to 25%. But maybe the benefit of this recognition of the performance obligations, the unrecognized or unsatisfied performance obligations, if that's all pure margin that's coming down, that might be offset by decreased margins on the hardware side because the ASPs are coming down. So that's one piece of the steel man. The other piece in here, let's see, is that like, so this amount of this $2.735 billion that CERN here is talking about, this is roughly the amount that we were talking about as being pure margin. As it relates to like the performance obligations of when you actually test the equipment, does it actually show that it's 3.9 megawatt hours? We don't know for sure that all of the $2.735 billion represents that type of like operational obligation and therefore potential margin profile. So like it seems reasonable to me that that's the case, and I can't for the life of me figure out what else it might be. But we don't know definitively that that is the case. So the last piece I would share is Zach Kirkhorn did give us margin guidance a couple of years ago that they're targeting long-term margins in the 25% range. And so to kind of, when Tesla has never said anything to the contrary, and frankly, they haven't given us guidance that this, you know, unsatisfied performance obligations is extremely high margin, we're kind of inferring that from, you know, some accounting, you know, trickery and, or digging, I should say. But like it really is unconfirmed speculation from us, even though I think it is, or from Larry specifically, even though it's, I think, very good work that I can't poke holes in, but it's unconfirmed. And so for that reason, it's worth taking it with a grain of salt.
So I think the way I'm thinking about this ultimately is with the growth of energy that we saw in Q2, with the understanding of what the capacity at Lathrop is, which is aligning very closely to the Q2 numbers that we're seeing from a deployment perspective. The fact that there is an equal amount of deployment in Shanghai that's going to go live next year, with the fact that in just the United States, if you assume half the jobs that are in queue for storage disappear, you still have Lathrop will only satisfy no more than 4% of the total queue for a single year from a year's worth of production, which says that there's a lot of pent-up demand, even if half the jobs don't come to fruition, right? So like the math I'm coming to is, even if this margin boost, let's say, is there, where about a third of the revenue becomes 100% gross margin because the cost is already recognized and it's just based on Tesla completing a job, which, correct me on my math here, so that essentially doubles, more than doubles, gross profit dollars, right? On the margin business, right? So even if that goes away, Tesla Energy is still going to become a very significant contributor to the bottom line for Tesla. That's only going to grow. And it's something that nobody, including us, has been paying attention to. The people that follow this the closest. And all of a sudden, this could become a giant thing. And nobody's talking about it.
I think that's a fair summary. I mean, we can debate about like the actual levels of the margin and that sort of thing. But like, what's very clear to me is like storage demand is massive, way bigger than they can reasonably satisfy in the near term. And Tesla's in great pole position to capitalize on that. and it's going to be at good margins. Maybe even if it compresses down from 25%, it's still going to be a really great business. And in the short term, I think it is a really nice catalyst at a time when the auto business is struggling a bit.
I was just going to say, and think about it, you know, just from a capital efficiency, like it's so much cheaper to set up a Megapack factory than it is to set up an auto factory to achieve the same type of overall revenue, like run rate.
Yeah, that is completely true. There was some post that Tesla Energy made a while ago about, I forget the exact dollar amount, but it was something like a $300 or $400 million investment in Shanghai for the Megapack factory. And everyone's like, oh, that's so cool to see that up and running. But then if you do the math of like the 40 gigawatt hours at a 25% margin, like what's the payback on that? It's weeks. It's like weeks to get your payback on that 300. It's insane. So like this is such a big deal.
And to piggyback on that, just, you know, China has been moving full steam ahead on, you know, they want to have 100 and some change new nuclear reactors online in the next few decades. And like, they just don't play around when it comes to regulations. Like, they don't let the regulatory environment slow down their plans to grow their energy production capacity. And so I think in all likelihood, you know, the China, like, it's very possible that Shanghai could be delivering 40 gigawatt hours a year before Lathrop is, and then would be like, okay, let's build another one and another one and another one just for China. Not to mention, yeah, there's like the whole rest of the world is all kind of in this same bucket, and all the utilities need to be doing this sort of thing. Like, the, you know, I think the terawatt hour, you know, multiple terawatt hours a year worth of demand, just in the United States, like, I think that scales across most of the world. And we're looking at, you know, an infrastructure build out that is just absolutely insane.
And all that quote unquote easy money that's coming from energy and all the profits they're generating from their auto business, which I want to talk about this before we wrap it up. This is all being used to invest in artificial intelligence. It's crazy. It's almost like Tesla has set up this mechanism where it's like, we're going to figure out the best ways to make money so that we can make artificial intelligence. And now they're very obviously executing on that goal.
Yeah. I mean, just, and this is a point that's well understood, but like, it bears repeating, they got their customers to pay for the privilege of training the data. Like, that's so, like, this plan is so brilliant. It is so, it's,
and such their an competitors to pay for the build out of their factories.
Yeah. And the competitors, and yeah, with the ZEV credits, right?
Yep.
Crazy. So what do you expect from Q2, Matt, from a margin perspective, from an energy perspective? And then if you have time, I want to play chess.
Yeah, sure. So, I haven't done the full kind of detailed model buildup that I, or at least like thinking through all the assumptions that I, you know, do before I publish the numbers. But I, you know, I made a couple quick changes, and you know, I'm coming up right now with earnings per share for Q2 of 63 cents, which is a lot higher than I had in my model just a couple days ago. I'm a little bit more skeptical than you are. You mentioned 20% auto gross margins with the discounting that they've been doing, and also the fact that their plants are not running at full capacity. And so that like fixed cost absorption, I think, is going to be a bit low. The Model 3 in Fremont is really not ramped up very well yet. Plus Cybertruck, like, while I'm sure margin has improved from where it was in Q1, I'm sure it's still not amazing. I've actually got auto gross margins decreasing a little bit. I'm at 17.3% right now. Fair amount of discounting and stuff that went on toward the end of the quarter too, mostly on demo vehicles. So I'm not sure that that's a huge impact. I'll tighten these up, but like, you know, I think energy is going to steal the show a bit here from auto.
17.3%. That's including lease and ZEV.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm not wedded to that. It was just, you know, I did a very quick, you know, I haven't done my fully detailed analysis. So, I very well might change that.
I guess where I'm stuck with that number though is that they're delivered over 50,000 more cars in Q2 versus Q1. So you would think that the fixed cost absorption would be way worse in Q1. So they were able to add those units, and the Cybertruck is further along the ramp, right? And they have FSD lower price at $99 per month, which should add something to the quarter as well.
Well, so I disagree with some of that. So for fixed cost absorption, what matters is production, not deliveries. So in Q1, they produced 433,000 vehicles. This quarter, they did, 411, I think. 411. So their actual production is down, which means that fixed cost absorption is going to be is going to be a little bit worse potentially this quarter. So I push back on that. Deliveries are nice, so but there'll be a cash flow benefit, but in terms of recognition on the income statement, I do think it's going to be a bit of pressure for that reason.
But I thought the way they recognize COGS is that they do it on delivered vehicles, not produced vehicles.
Well, they do, but all the vehicles that they produced in Q2 were either manufactured in Q1 or in Q2, right? And so the my point is the production between those two time periods is actually very similar. So it was, 411 if production this quarter, and in Q1 it was 433. So they actually had higher production and therefore higher fixed cost better fixed cost absorption in Q1 than they presumably will in Q2.
I see. So even though they delivered a much lower number in Q1, they were able to produce more cars in Q1, which would have lowered the fixed cost of absorption, obviously, because they're producing more cars. Whereas in Q2, they produce a little bit less cars, but they deliver more cars, of those cars that they produced in that quarter, they would have sold through. So let me ask you this question. How are you thinking about all the cars in inventory that they built in Q1 from that 430,000 produced number or 440?
Something like that.
So wouldn't a lot of those, cars be sold in Q2?
And so then those should have a pretty similar margin profile to what we saw in Q1.
I see.
And the Q1 margin was, 18.5% I've got here. Yeah. So if you've got, a good chunk of the deliveries at that 18.5% gross margin, and then you've got, lower production for the things that you both made and delivered in Q2, to me, it just seems reasonable that there's going to be a bit of a steady state on the margins, maybe even a slight decline. But then the other piece on FSD. So I do think you're going to have a lot of people opting for the subscription, which is going to be nice. But I think you're going to see a pretty steep decrease in the number of people who are buying FSD outright when the monthly option is so attractive. So that's potential, and that's all margin. So when I'm looking at my FSD revenue assumption in Q1, I was estimating about $600 million in FSD revenue. And even though I've got a higher overall take rate because it's monthly and at a low rate, I'm assuming that FSD actually drops to, I'm losing my mind here, to just under $400 million. So I think like FSD subscriptions are going to be great in the long run because it'll be cumulative. And after you've been doing this for a bunch of years, you'll have hundreds of thousands or millions of people subscribing to them. But in the short term, I think that's actually a slight negative.
I see. Okay. So that's helpful to understand. What about all the glut of batteries and the lower lithium prices? How are you thinking about that in Q2?
Yeah. I mean, that could certainly help the margin profile. So that's something I need to think a bit more about is how significant of an impact is that, lower cell cost on auto COGS? Because it definitely helps for sure.
Okay. And then Cybertruck being much further along in the ramp at much higher ASPs than average, don't you think that's going to help margins?
It'll help ASP. What I try to think about is what is the gross margin of that vehicle relative to the company average gross margin, let's say. While they've got an amazing ASP and I'm sure they're profitable on it, at like, let's say it's $100,000 average price. Is their COGS 80,000? It might be just because of how high the fixed costs are with like them ramping that line. And I'm sure they've got a lot of scrap and just like rework and like random errors with them ramping the product. And so like, I think it's probably not going to move the needle that much. And then couple that with like how many vehicles are they actually selling? I mean, if it's 5,000 or 10,000 units that they sold in Q2, even if it is, let's say a 30% gross margin, which I'm skeptical of, it just doesn't move the needle a whole lot on the overall company-wide gross margin.
Okay. Do you have time for chess? We'll do a bonus content.
Yeah. What are you thinking? What kind of game?
Whatever you have time for.
Well, I'm thinking 10 minute would actually probably be super boring for people.
You want the 3-2?
Maybe we could do like a bullet and maybe a 3-2. I don't know. Maybe
two games. Bullet. Okay. Can I warm up with a 3-2 first?
Yeah, sure.
Here we go.
3-2.
Oh God. All right. Oh,
I hate that my rating is lower than yours on here.
You're white. Go.
I'm the whitest guy you'll ever meet.
How come you're not playing the London now? What happened?
You know nothing.
It's true.
Huh. That was unexpected, I bet.
Yeah. Why are you playing a completely different open than I usually play? This is not cool.
Because I thought you were going to, you know, you were asking for hints. You're like, oh, what do you usually play? I'm going to mess you up, man.
Man, I don't even know what I'm doing. Fuck. Okay.
And I feel the need to explain that I was rated higher than you like last week when we first played.
Yes.
And I like went on this tear where I should not have been playing chess because I was just like, my brain was not functional. And I lost like 70 points or something like that in one sitting. It was insane.
I've done that before. I've done that drunk.
I wish I was like, I wish I had the excuse that I was drunk at least, but like I didn't. Yeah. I was just like, tired.
Sometimes I'll play chess when I'm drunk and I'll lose so many points and I'm like, I'm never going to do this again, but I still do it. Okay. What do I want to do here? I don't like my position at all.
I think your position's fine.
I think it's terrible. See, I'm like, man.
I love how stressed out you are about this.
I'm so stressed out.
Ooh, you're going fast now.
What are you going to do? That's the key question here.
Great question. Man, you like bring the hard hitting questions.
Do I even care about that? I don't think I do.
What a bad boy. Let's see.
Can I beat you on time? That's my strategy with you sometimes. It's like I try to beat you on time.
Well, it worked that one time. We played two games for the audience at home. We played a 10-minute, and I didn't realize until halfway through that there was no increment, which means extra time is added with each turn. And so I had you down to like a king, your king only versus my queen and like a pawn or something like that. But we drew because I ran out of time.
Yeah.
And then the other game I won outright. So, but those were private games. I got to win this one for bragging rights. What do you think you're doing?
Honestly, I have no idea. To be completely honest, I have no idea.
Those games when like you literally have no idea. Like you're trying to come up with like a strategy or like something you're trying to get. Yeah. And you just cannot come up with one for the life of you.
I'm just trying not to blunder, and I'm pretty sure I already did.
Like, I've got to actually take advantage of it, which is a very big question mark at this point.
Yeah. Huh? Okay.
Connect four.
Okay. I don't like this.
I think it's fine.
I think it's terrible. Oh, God.
That is what I want to hear.
Yeah, this is not going to end well.
Oh, you're down on time, too. Oh, I shouldn't have said that.
Yeah. I'm way down on time. Fuck, this game was terrible for me. Okay. How do I prevent this from being a total clusterfuck? That's not going to help at all.
I'm going to move the upper knight back in.
Ooh. I mean, not just a pawn push.
Come on.
No.
Oh my God, that was so dumb. Why did I do that? Wow.
You were low on time. I thank you for that, though. I do appreciate it.
That was so stupid. Shit.
Oh gosh, that was almost very dumb.
Another one.
I do not understand.
Do I promote or do I? Yeah, I guess it doesn't hurt anything to just take that and then promote. You got my pawn. Oh, actually, I see what you're trying to do here. That is a good idea. But I say no.
Fuck! Damn it! That was yes! So bad. Okay.
You are an idiot, and I am superior.
I'm so bad. All right, let's do.
Oh my gosh! The truth is, we both played like absolute hot garbage in that game.
Hold on, let me pull it up. What was the analysis? Oh my God, the accuracy is so bad. That is my.
I ever do.
Oof! That was bad. Okay. Do you have time for a bullet?
Sure.
Okay. This is going to be the worst game of all time. All right. Go.
You are done. I've already mated you.
Probably.
Oh, dang it. I actually hit the wrong slot. Lost a tempo.
So annoying. I hate that. It's going to end worse than the other one. Oh, great. Dude, so bad. So bad.
Let's see. I'm actually not sure what best to do here. You know what? Screw it.
Yeah, that was your thing. Again, that was a stupid move.
On you or my part? I'm actually not sure if it was like, ooh. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's dumb. Oof. Oh my God. Huh? Damn it, no.
Yeah, 2 for 2. Actually,
terrible.
I think cumulatively, I'm 3.5 out of 4 against you. So
yeah. All right, I'm going to quit while I'm behind.
Now. You got to respect me.
All right, well, there you go.
How do we play? So I had 66% accuracy in the bullet game versus, what was it, like 50 in the long?
Yeah, in the, you had better accuracy in bullet? So did I.
So did you, by the way. I played the bullet game earlier. Oh. I had like 89% accuracy. Like, how does that even happen?
Dang, luck. All right, well, congrats. Great. I can't wait to edit this out. I'm kidding.
So glad to have killed another small piece of your soul, which is small to begin with.